You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 50, Avery Brooksisms. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including James Doohan's ashes reaching space, a Klingon invasion of Star Trek London, a chance to purchase the original Galileo 7 shuttlecraft, TNG Blu-ray pricing, Michael Dorn's Worf movie, some movie news and rumors, and the largest gathering of captains on one stage ever conceived. Then in the feature, we're joined by Ben McCormick and Matt Hansen to discuss the DS9 pilot episode, Emissary. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I am doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's warming up here, which is something that my nose loves, but at least we get a little bit of sunshine before rainy season kicks in. So
that's good. That's good. Yeah, I've been enjoying this oddly sunny Seattle weekend by sitting in my bedroom watching Next Gen. I've watched pretty much seasons 4 through 6 over the last 4 or 5 days. So ask me anything.
Well, I remember last week in the feature, you said that you were going to start keeping a chart of who is sleeping with whom on the Enterprise.
And what yes.
I thought it was a good idea, but what I didn't understand is that you were going to actually send me iMessages as a way of cataloging who is sleeping with whom, because I have received a steady stream of iMessages from you all through the weekend. Now Riker is sleeping with so-and-so. Now he's sleeping with an androgynous being. Ooh, now Nurse Ogawa is getting some action.
Yes, exactly. I had no idea. When I was 11 watching the show, I had no idea all of the stuff that was going on. But wow, it's pretty intense.
Yeah. So now I am reliving all of the hotter moments from The Next Generation without even watching the series again. So it's the magic of iMessage.
That's good. Yeah, be looking forward to my ebook coming out, Sex of Next Gen.
Oh, hey, that'll be a big seller, I think.
I think so.
So, Greg, I have something for you right off the bat this week. I have a big slice of cellular peptide cake with mint frosting for you, because this is actually our one-year anniversary show.
Yes, it is. Can you believe we've made it an entire year?
It is amazing. And we only missed 2 shows as the year went on. This is our 50th show. And our first show went out last year on May 31st. And this one will drop on the 29th.
Wow.
So we made it through an entire year. And
yeah. As my dad said when I talked to him this week, what is there to say about Star Trek every week?
You know, I get that every time I tell someone, oh, yeah, I do a podcast. It's about Star Trek. And they're like, oh, you do that like every month or something. I said, no, every week. And they go, every week? Is there really something to talk about every week about Star Trek? Yeah, of course there
apparently
is.
So.
Apparently so. And if there's not, we'll just make something up.
Sure.
But we've gotten some birthday wishes from Germany. It's amazing that we have listeners all over the world. I guess it shouldn't be so amazing to me considering that I live in Japan, but we do have listeners all over the world. And Renee, who writes in to us quite often, who also goes by the name of Mares from the animated series. Renee sent us some birthday wishes, and she did it in video fashion by sending us a clip of Worf's birthday from The Next Generation with Dr. Crusher giving Worf the cake. And she also sent us a message. She says, congratulations on your 50th episode and first anniversary. Your show is a joy to listen to and has broadened my horizons in the Trek universe immensely. Here's to many more episodes and anniversaries. Kapla! Mares.
Aw, thank you very much.
So we have a felinoid saying kapla to us, which is quite interesting. But thank you, Renee, for those wishes. We always appreciate your support and are glad that we've been able to broaden your horizons, as you say, in Star Trek. And we've also had a few shout outs from some shows, our friends at the Delta Quadrant as well. I just heard, I'm a little bit behind on all my podcasts, so I haven't gotten to all the latest episodes of every show I listen to yet. The problem is I listen to too many shows, and I have limited time to get to them all. But thanks to you guys over at the Delta Quadrant and everyone else for any birthday wishes. We really appreciate your support.
Yes, we do.
So, Greg, it's time to charge into our second year of the Ready Room. And our first story is a rather touching one, I think.
It is. And this is something that's been coming for quite a while. But it's glad to finally see it come true. It's that James Doohan's ashes have finally reached the final frontier.
That's right. Now, they attempted to do this about 4 years ago when they were going to carry a sample of his ashes up. This is SpaceX, which is a private company that does provide services to NASA and the International Space Station. And the first attempt failed a couple of years ago, and that was the Falcon 1 rocket. But they have, of course, a lot more experience now, and these rockets have been refined. And this was the Falcon 9, which they launched, not just to carry Doohan's ashes, but to...
Right.
Go and test out some various procedures and technologies with a module called the Dragon to prepare for future missions to the International Space Station, where they'll actually dock with the station.
Well, did they not dock this time? My understanding was they actually did. Was it Wednesday or Tuesday or Wednesday? They actually did dock with the space station, didn't they?
They did dock in the end. I knew initially they were going to do a flyby, and then they were going to come very close, within 1.5 miles of the ISS. And then I think after that was cleared, then that was proof that they could safely dock, and so then they would go ahead and do that. So
yeah, so I believe they did. I mean, this was big news over this past week among space nerds, and I have a lot of space nerd friends, and everyone is very excited that this private company is launching a successful rocket into not only orbit but actually have the ability to dock with the space station. Obviously we're looking for a, you know, no money future as it comes to Star Trek, but private enterprise doing this and actually pushing things forward is great, and it's fantastic that they were able to do this program that was designed to get Scotty's ashes into space as well.
Yeah, it is. And I think that there is no better mission to be undertaking for Scotty's ashes and James Doohan's ashes to finally go into space as a mission that tests technology and engineering concepts to, you know, help us take that next step into space. So it's a perfect fit for Scotty and everything that he represents in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, definitely.
So
great touching
moment.
Story.
All right. So moving on to the next story. Now, last week we talked about how the Wizard World Con in Philadelphia trumped Star Trek London by securing all five captains this summer. And we kind of speculated on what Star Trek London might be able to do to counter that. And they did make one announcement this week that the Klingons are going to invade Destination Star Trek London.
Nice. Yeah, a trio. They've got J.J. Hertzler, Robert O'Reilly, and Gwyneth Walsh, which the more epic fans will know that that's Martok, Gowron, as well as Bator. Now, I don't know where Lurs is at, but they've got three Klingons, and that's more Klingons than they had before.
Yes. When you said that sentence at first, you said they have Gwyneth Walsh, who fans will know as Martok. That's what I thought you were saying.
No.
Like, wow, that was some spectacular makeup work they were doing on Deep Space Nine. Wow.
Right.
Yes. I think these actors have been fairly active on the cons. Weren't they in Star Trek Las Vegas last summer? I think they had all the Klingons. Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty much at every con. If you were a Klingon, you're going to be at pretty much every con possible.
Yeah. Well, I think Lursa was at the at Vegas last year.
I believe so, too.
Yeah. Because they had that whole Klingon breakfast where you have to eat pancakes with gach on top and you drink blood wine
for breakfast. Yeah.
I had some blood wine at brunch. It may have been a Bloody Mary, but I thought of it as blood wine.
Well, you know, prune juice is a true warrior's drink. Who needs that? Yes, old indeed. Blood wine? Yeah. But yeah, so this is going to take place again. This is Star Trek Destination London, October 19th to 21st at the Excel London. And so if you are a Klingon fan, you will be able to meet and have your photo taken with Martok, Gowron, and Bator. And Hertzler and O'Reilly, the two of them are going to be together, of course, from their Deep Space Nine connections. And then right. Walsh is going to have a solo photo session as well. And they're giving away a prize as well. You can actually get the latex Gowron forehead that O'Reilly wore at the FedCon 21 in Dusseldorf earlier this year.
Oh, nice. That'd be pretty cool.
So if you know, have any dinner parties coming up or anything, that would be a fantastic headpiece for you to wear.
Right.
So you can pick up the tickets, get more information over at StarTrekLondon.com. There is an online entry form if you want to get in to this drawing for the Klingon forehead, and the deadline for that is May 31st. So you need to actually get on over there just within the next couple of days after this show drops if you want to be entered into that drawing. Yeah. So you head over to that.
Yeah. So yeah, Star Trek London has added a trio of Klingons. Your move, Wizard World.
Well, Wizard World, they're really going to have to pull their heads together, because Destination Star Trek London is not the only con that they're going up against. Last week, we also had our idea on how to basically outdo Wizard World in a way that just can't be topped. And our loyal listener, Will Decker, he just kind of grabbed that idea and ran with it. And he has, with lightning speed, in the course of 1 week, organized what may be the best Star Trek convention ever held.
Yeah, Chris. They sent along a commercial that I just saw. I mean, look at this. April. Pike. Pike. Kirk. Kirk. Decker. Spock. Spock. Picard. Picard. Riker. Jellicoe. Archer. Janeway. Sisko. Braxton, Terrell, Esteban, Stiles, Sulu, Harriman, Garrett, Hernandez.
Hernandez.
Also appearing, Captain Bateson, Captain Benteen, Captain Baudet, Captain Braxton, the other one, Captain Crusher, Captain Dunsel, Captain Kang, Captain Keel, Captain Claw, Captain Koloth, Captain Geordi LaForge. Wait, who's the... Okay. Now I can't even continue. I don't know who Captain S. LaForge is.
That's Geordi's mother.
Oh, right? Of course.
From Oh, goodness. I'm glad Captain Claw is going to be there. I mean, they have Klingons at Star Trek London now, but they don't have Claw.
They don't have Claw. They certainly don't have Captain Proton. They certainly don't have Gul Dukat. Oh, Captain, my Captain.
I'm really, really glad to see that they actually have the T'Neil's captain there as well.
And breaking boundaries, they even have Captain Skywalker.
Yes, they do.
So where can we see this grand collection of the 47 captains?
Well, this is kind of equal opportunity, pretty much no matter where you are. This is going to be broadcast live on the Federation subspace from the interdimensional, interplanal, intertimeline arena on Rigel 7. So if you've wanted to see the galaxy, this is your chance.
Right. And I believe that they have even scooped Star Trek London, because they'll be appearing, well, according to the Temarian calendar, as Semlock sees the tide.
Yes. That's the date. So... if you would like to pre-order tickets for this con, you can do so, as Semlock Sees the Tide is the date of the convention.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. Or you can use the prophet's calendar if you'd like to, and you can get your tickets maybe a year from now or maybe yesterday, because time. What is this time?
Linear existence. Linear procreation.
All right. So if you want to know more about this amazing kind, they say that you should follow Will Decker on Twitter.
Yes.
And that is, he's really there. Now, we're not just saying that. You can follow Will Decker. He's always wearing his baby blue motion picture uniform. So give him a follow. I mean, this is fantastic thing yes. here that Will Decker has put together. I'm glad that our Ready Room silliness could inspire someone to create such an awesome poster.
Yes, indeed. I'm looking forward to getting a copy of it for my wall.
We should print this.
Definitely.
All right. Well, moving on, Greg, we have another bit of news here. And this one is from the original series. Apparently, the original Galileo 7 shuttlecraft prop is going to be auctioned off.
Yeah, apparently the current owner has changed his plans and wants to sell it. So is it Monday, June 18th is when it begins? And yeah, it's the actual, like, it's a full-size shuttlecraft prop that was put together for the filming of the show.
Right, right. And looking wow. at the photos of this, I would love to buy this and pull it around like a camper.
Yes.
I mean, if you go camp, how cool would that be to go camping with this? You pull in like with your big SUV or maybe an old Chrysler, and you pull into the campgrounds and you got this behind you. And don't right. don't clean it up either. Keep it exactly the condition that it is in the photo here, where it looks like it's been in the bottom of a dump for the past 40 years in a scrapyard somewhere, and someone pulled it out. Pull in with that and camp for the weekend. That'd be awesome. Roasting marshmallows right outside. Heat the rocks up with your phaser.
Yeah, it does not look like it stood the test of time very well. Perhaps too many spears have been lobbed at it by interns, you know, off camera.
Oh, but I have to say, I would not be surprised if this fetches quite a handsome sum of money, because this is actually the original prop that was used in the episode The Galileo 7. It's 24 feet long, it's 9 feet wide, and they say it's approximately 40% restored inside, which, as you know from the episode, there wasn't much inside to start yes. with. So if restoring 40% of what we saw on the inside in that episode, I'm not sure. Right. Maybe they put the panel cover back on after Scotty ripped it off so he could jiggle that thing right. and electrocute the single creature that was on the outside.
Right. It may be cheaper to build your own, but for pure nostalgia or, you know, authenticity, this is the only one you're going to get that actually had James Doohan inside, you know, jiggling that sonic screwdriver for way too long.
Right. And I'm just reading here. I'm picturing this if you flip through the newspaper and you're looking through the classifieds.
Right.
And you see this description, which is the actual description here that we got from TrekNews.net in their shuttle details about this. Approximately 40% restored inside. Outside needs work. All parts, pieces, paperwork to transfer, as well as titled trailer shuttle is on. 2, thruster domes missing and 1 foot peg. Seller goals have changed and desires immediate sale.
Yes. It doesn't exactly inspire confidence that if you look at the picture, one of the tires on the trailer is actually flat.
That's true. I'm looking at the picture right now, yeah. So I guess if you want to buy this and tow it back, you need to bring an extra tire.
Yes. First step is to change the tire on the trailer.
Oh, so true. But at the same time, if you are a fan of yes. the original series, this would be a really cool piece of memorabilia to have.
Yes.
And just yes. park in your yard. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you know, that room of mine that has, you know, 7 of 9's alcove and Commander Adama's table.
So say we all.
In the other corner can just... Galileo 7. Because sometimes you just need a place to go in and just think for a little while.
You could set up your PlayStation inside there.
Right.
Put a flat screen up there in the front where the pilot controls would have been.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, Greg, some news came out this week, some additional news about the next generation Blu-ray release. You know, we've speculated on here many times over the course of the past 6 months or so about what the pricing would be like. And you've actually always speculated a little bit lower than I have.
Yeah, Chris, I just assumed that CBS would understand that if they priced the Blu-rays reasonably, they would sell more. You know, we're looking at a more mainstream audience for next gen right now, and it doesn't make sense to price exorbitantly. So that was my expectation, but came out this weekend, and what's the damage we're looking at?
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, I am really disappointed in CBS about this pricing, and they just slapped the standard $129.99 price tag on the season one Blu-ray set. It's the same price that they put on the DVD sets when they originally came out as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, back when those started coming out about 10 years ago, it wasn't so common to have full season collections of TV series. You know, that was kind of something people were starting to do. I mean, I say it wasn't common. I mean, there were a lot of them around, but it wasn't like now where things come out like the season ends and like 3 months later, the whole previous season is already out on DVD and, you know, every store you go to. But these days, it's common practice that every television show is going to come out in season box sets right after that season ends. And they're typically priced, because I went to look to be sure what the U.S. rates were like these days, typically between $49 and $79.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're $29. Sometimes they're $100, but usually $49 to $79.
Yeah, and something like Game of Thrones that just came out that's very expensive, you know, that's priced at maybe $60. You know, that's the high end. And I understand that's fewer shows, and we're talking 26 episodes for next gen, but it's a series that's 25 years old.
And not only that, but it's a series that diehard fans who buy these box sets have already bought the DVD box sets.
Right.
So we already own this material. And I know there are going to be a few bonus features that we haven't seen before. And I know we're going to get the HD quality, and we all want to see it. But to expect people to drop $129 or the Amazon discounted price of $91 on these sets and do it seven times, I think it's crazy, especially when people are watching Next Generation on Netflix right now.
That's the thing. It's on Netflix. And unless they take it off of Netflix, which that's going to cause an outroar. But if they leave it on there and people think, well, let's see, I could spend $90 to get the Blu-ray, or I could just watch it for free, you know, with my subscription. I'm probably going to shell out the money for it no matter what it costs. Because A, I'm doing this show. I'm doing the podcast with Trek FM. And B, I'm a very big Star Trek nerd. And I'm a video quality nerd. And I love seeing these restorations. So they probably would have a hard time pricing it out of what I would spend. $129 might actually be outside of that. But as long as it's under $100, I'm probably still going to shell out for it. I spent something like that for Star Wars, the Blu-rays that came out for the whole set.
Yeah, if it's under $100, maybe. But, I mean, you think about it. If it's $91, it's a purchase that you kind of have to think about and you have to plan that. If it's $59 and you're walking through Target and it's sitting there for $59 and you're a big Star Trek fan, you might just grab it and take it to the register and buy it. I mean, I don't understand their strategy here, but I've seen a lot of complaints online already about this pricing. But if you guys in the United States think that you have it bad, let me tell you what the price is in Japan. The TNG Blu-ray set for season one in Japan, the retail price is 26,460 yen. That comes out to $333.
Oh my God.
So CBS is expecting us to drop $333 seven times if we want to collect the next generation Blu-ray sets for seven seasons. It's absolutely insane.
Understand they have to have people individually paddle those Blu-ray sets from the United States to Japan, and paying each of those people in the canoe, you know, for 6 months, it's expensive.
It must be feeding
them, clothing them. I don't know what they're thinking. Because if you're in Japan and you're a Star Trek fan, I mean, yes, I understand the market's smaller, but it's not so small that you can justify this. It doesn't mean that you're rich because you're in Japan and you're a Star Trek fan.
And it's not like they had to dish out a lot of money to do the translations or to do the voiceovers because all that stuff was already done in the past.
Right.
Here they're remastering the visuals. They're not bringing in new voice actors to record everything all over again also. This is standard pricing traditionally in Japan for Star Trek box sets, just like 129 is standard in the US. 26,000 yen is standard here. But as some studios like 20th Century Fox in Japan is finally breaking out of this mold and releasing their content for around 4,500 yen. You see here with CBS, they're sticking to their guns of this, you know, $333 equivalent pricing. So I'm very disappointed. I hope that these prices will come down. I mean, I know that they will come down eventually. I think it's a shame that so many fans who have been looking forward to this are going to be priced out of getting this stuff. Like myself, you know, you're priced out of getting this stuff as soon as it's released, and we'll have to kind of wait and hope that places like Costco or Sam's will get them in and sell them for like $50 or something. So it's disappointing.
It really is, especially considering I just spent, you know, $20 to get three of these episodes in advance. And there's no sort of discount program that they've talked about for people who bought the next level Blu-ray. So it's really disappointing. I'm really hoping that this news changes. We're still looking at what, 2 months before the actual set's released. So hopefully we'll get some sort of announcement that they've figured out that they've gone insane.
Maybe, although I doubt it.
I
really doubt it.
Well, and let's see, someone else who probably needs to come to their senses this week is Michael Dorn, who was speaking. I believe it was it an interview or was it a convention appearance?
I think it was at a con.
I believe so. He was speaking at a con and basically talking about how he wants to do maybe not a new Trek series, but at least a Trek movie, a lower budget made for TV movie, basically starring Worf. Which actually, this is not a bad idea. I mean, this would be a prime timeline movie done sort of in the way that they made the Stargate SG-1 direct DVD movies.
I mean, I think the idea of some new material featuring Worf, in this case it would be Captain Worf, who is a captain of a Federation starship. I mean, I think the idea is interesting enough, and it's great that Michael Dorn wants to continue that. I don't know. Personally, for me, the idea of straight-to-DVD movies for Star Trek is not all that appealing, just because I kind of have a... I don't know. Maybe I'm an old fogey or something, but the idea of anything that's like straight-to-DVD kind of has a little bit of a small franchise connotation to it or something, even though I do know they did it for Stargate, and Stargate's a huge franchise, but... but I think, I think the idea could be interesting. I think the reality of getting it made, though, is not very realistic.
That's the only problem. The thing. And he talked about lining a meeting up with Sci-Fi. He said he wanted to talk to Rick Berman first, and then talk to Sci-Fi, and then see what would need to be done as far as with CBS. I just, you know, as we've talked about so many times before, it's going to be so hard to get a project like this off the ground. I mean, Rick Berman can't go into J.J. Abrams' office and say, hey, J.J., we're going to do such and such. No, it's the franchise is going in a certain direction. And maybe if he'd pitched this back in, you know, 2004, he might have gotten more of a hold on things. But it's, you know, I think the time has sort of passed. But I certainly love the idea. I'd love to see this as a comic, really.
Yeah, a comic series, it could work quite well. Yeah. Absolutely. Have Captain Worf, the concept that he's on a Federation starship kind of out on the borders and he's chasing terrorists, fighting terrorists, and it would be, you know, darker kind of storyline, maybe more like the Worf of DS9 type flavor.
Yeah.
And it would make an awesome comic series for sure. As a television series, I think no matter how good the concept is, Sci-Fi cannot just do it because they don't own the rights to Star Trek.
Right.
And CBS, they can't do it. even if they want to, as I understand it, because Paramount really has control of the franchise right now with the movies, and they're not going to return to the prime timeline while all the JJ stuff's going on either. So yeah, I don't see it happening. It's an interesting concept though. And I do love the fact that Michael Dorn is still so strongly connected. You know, he still has such a love for Star Trek. After he has put in more time with Star Trek than any actor, and and he's still so connected to it. So that's wonderful. But I guess what I would hope for, as far as this is concerned, is that maybe he would realize that it's not going to happen as a TV series, and then he would take the concept to IDW and talk to them about doing a comic series.
I mean, I've actually been reading this Titan novel, and I've actually been kind of getting more interested in the idea of continuing Star Trek adventures in the books and comics. I've been kind of, whatever, about the concept. But reading this novel, which is Seize the Fire, I'm like, oh, no, this is actually pretty cool. So, but of course, Worf isn't a part of that. So I'd love to see, you know, what's Worf doing at the, you know, turn of the 24th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be cool.
One day after work, he said, I went down to the Cambie for a beer. I couldn't believe my eyes as I walked inside. Oh, I was utterly hypnotized. See, there was this stunning waitress running the bar. She was dressed to the nines. She was mesmerizing. I mean, she could launch 1,000 ships of mine anytime. Meanwhile, the boys from the boat sat up at the bar and they smoked and joked. And drank whiskey and poke-funded me in my femi garb. Well, you got style, Cupcake, but make no mistake, they laugh. She's way out of your league. You're an odd catch, and you're no match for a classy broad like that.
So, Cupcake sat alone. So, Greg, I do love my cupcakes. And, of course, you know, there was a big cupcake in the last JJ movie. And apparently, according to news that's come out this week, the actor who played Cupcake, Jason Matthew Smith, says that he's going to be returning in the sequel.
Yeah, and this is fantastic. Did we actually end up talking about it a couple weeks ago when we were doing the Vulcan's Vengeance arc that Cupcake was a part of?
Yeah. We did talk about him being there. In fact, we named the episode "Don't Call Me Cupcake."
We did indeed. So this is maybe the first thing that was hinted at in the comic that we're finding out is actually going to be in the sequel. I don't know how big a role he's going to have, but according to the comic, he's, you know, a part of the Enterprise's security team, and he and Kirk seem to still be keeping in touch with their little rivalry.
Right. Yeah. It is interesting that he is posted to the Enterprise and he has to serve under Kirk after all of, you know, the bar scene and everything. It's kind of funny. And that plays out in the comics too, you know, where you kind of, those scenes where in Vulcan's Vengeance, where Kirk calls him Cupcake and he says something like, Captain, I've told you, or I've asked you not to call me Cupcake.
So many times.
Like, you know, he has to respect the captain right now, but yet he still kind of has that lingering feeling like, this is the little punk that I beat up in the bar, you know? So, I don't know. I imagine it would be, you know, kind of a small part here, and maybe he goes on a mission, a away mission with them, and he plays some kind of part, like Zara's been playing a lot in the comics,
right? You
know, something like that. So anyway, it's good to see that they're maintaining that continuity though, and that we get these characters, because we had a lot of characters like this, you know, even on the Next Generation. You had a lot of background officers like this who you saw turn up in episodes all the way through the series, and I like that because it does create more of a sense that this is a whole group of people.
Yeah,
not just bridge crew plus whoever else happens to be walking by the set this day.
Yeah, I didn't realize Nurse Ogawa, like, I had no idea she was a character until this viewing of Next Gen. I'm like, that's the same nurse, like, every time. Apparently she's an actual character. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. No, she's, you know, as you had Nurse Chapel in the original series, Nurse Ogawa is around all through the Next Generation.
Yeah. And, of course, now she's head nurse on the Titan. So.
That's right. Oh, goodness. Okay, well, a bit more movie news here. It's not really a big bit of news, but apparently, you know, now that they've finished shooting, Quinto has said goodbye to his Spock hair.
Ah, that horrible, terrible bowl cut that he has to get.
It just, you wonder why he'd get rid of that. Wouldn't you think you'd want to hang on to that? I mean, that's got to be a lady magnet.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, what with the half-shaved eyebrows and the bowl cut. Yeah, I'm sure. It is a bit weird looking at pictures of Nimoy from the 60s and 70s when he doesn't have his Spock hair on. And it's just like, that's Spock, but it's missing something of that core Spockness.
That's right, the core Spockness. Oh man, wouldn't it be something? You remember when Friends was very popular and all the girls got the Jennifer Aniston haircut? Wouldn't it be awesome if it became a fad where all the men in the world started getting the Zachary Quinto spot haircut?
That would be pretty fantastic. Let's see if that happens. 2013, let's make it happen. Spock hair, 2013.
I remember well in 1992 when I heard that Star Trek was going to be spun off once again with a new series called Deep Space Nine. And I also remember well the premiere of Deep Space Nine on January 3rd of 1993. And there was a lot of clamor about how far this new series diverged from The Next Generation and what Star Trek had been before. So today we're going to talk about the pilot episode Emissary, and to help us do that, we have two first-time guests on the Ready Room, but two people that most of our listeners are familiar with. From the Delta Quadrant podcast, we have Matt Hansen. Hello, Matt.
Hello, I'm so excited to be here. Happy 50th show.
Welcome. Oh, thank you. And thank also you. From Dork Trek, we have Lieutenant Commander Ben McCormick. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, good to be here, and I'll try to keep it clean.
Well, we went a little Dork Trek ourselves last week for about
20
minutes.
Yeah, you guys are slowly becoming more and more R-rated. I think Dork Trek is rubbing off on you.
I don't know. I think we're PG-13 at best. So,
yeah, it's when we have Charlene on or we have Michael on, and I don't know, just them and me and Chris is trying to help it, but it's going off into crazy rat holes.
Oh man. So Matt, on your show you focus on Voyager, and Ben, on your show you focus on The Next Generation, but I know that both of you love Deep Space Nine, so I thought you would be the perfect two guests to help us talk about Emissary. So Ben, why don't you start us off just with your initial impressions of Emissary when it first came on?
Oh, when I first watched this, because I've been watching Star Trek since the 70s, so when Emissary came on, I had just started liking TNG and gotten over my shock of, this isn't Star Trek. Well, okay, now TNG is Star Trek also. Now what's this? Hated the theme song.
Oh, you did?
Probably the first three seasons.
Oh, yeah.
Could not stand it. Mm. It was too artsy. It wasn't Star Trek. Uh-huh. And then the idea that they're on a space station, just sitting there. Okay, how much adventure can you do with that? And I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, that they were able to do something with it. But the way it tied into Next Generation very smoothly, but at the same time, it was still in-universe, but it had grown into, hey, there's other places in the Federation. Enterprise isn't the only place where some action's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up loving the show.
A lot of action going on the Enterprise, as we know. So it took you a while to warm up to it anyway. But
yeah,
but then you
probably about third season is when I really picked up.
Well, what about you, Matt?
Well, I have to start off with a confession right away. I didn't get to see Emissary when it first ran. I was A, living out of the country at the time.
Really?
And yeah, and B, I was 4 when it premiered.
I was going to say, were you born yet when when DS9 premiered?
Wow.
In fact, I hadn't even watched my first episode of Star Trek. It wasn't until Generations when I saw that in the theaters when I was 5 that I even got into the show.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Now you're making me feel old. It's usually me making Larry feel old when I say things like that, but now I know where he's coming from.
But anyways, I was able to catch on it much later, and I'm glad that I did, because when I first started watching Star Trek, TNG and Voyager were very easy for, you know, my young mind at the time to understand. You know, it was a space adventure show, Aliens of the Week, that sort of thing. But the thing that I love about Deep Space Nine is that for the first time, and I love TNG and I love the characters on TNG, but I would argue that DS9, more than really any of the other Star Treks, is the most character-oriented show. It's mm-hmm. definitely the one that develops the most arcs for their characters. And when I saw Emissary for the first time, it was so radically different from everything that I'd seen before, but in a way that made me very excited. And I think, you know, what my feelings on the episode and the series as a whole is that TNG may have planted the seeds of the 24th century, but DS9 watered them and made them grow. And it made the 24th century feel so much bigger than it was.
Right. Because, yeah, you felt the size of the universe. We've talked about that a number of times, about how you feel there's so much more going on instead of you're seeing glimpses here and there through the Next Generation, which is great. But the interaction between all the different worlds around the Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant, and so forth, you didn't see as much.
Right.
Right. And, you know, that's kind of what makes it, the fact that it's a station, they can't run away from their problems. You know, they're always going to be dealing with the Cardassians.
Right.
And the Bajorans and everybody going in and out of the wormhole. They're not going to be off on some random, you know, it feels like every 3 episodes, the Enterprise is transporting a diplomat to some planet we've never heard of.
On a mission to transport a diplomat to a meaningless conference.
Right.
No, they're going to the outpost. Great. Remember the outpost. The outpost.
Oh, yes. And there's always outpost. It's like, well, is this diplomat going to be evil, or is he going to bring an evil person with him, or is he just going to attract evil people? Oh, God. So DS9 doesn't do that, because DS9's always sitting there. The trouble comes to them. And it's not the same trouble, but it's this, as you say, it somehow expands the universe while being in this small place. Because I think that's just because they can't be jumping off to some place we've never heard of. They're always at the same place in the Alpha Quadrant.
Right.
It allows for more drama, because I think a lot of people were concerned at first that, well, the ship can't go places, so it's going to be really boring. It's going to be like a soap opera inside the station. But in reality, well, it's thanks to the wormhole. Now, if the wormhole weren't there, maybe that would have happened. But it turns out to be such a political and economic center for activity that it's actually a better arrangement than the Next Generation was, in a way, because it's very natural. It's very organic, the way that drama can come to our crew on the station.
Growing up, I was my grandmother was a huge fan of the Westerns. And one of the shows that we watched every week was Gunsmoke. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, in Dodge City, it's the town, you've got the sheriff, you've got, you know, the standard Western setup. And you really get that vibe from this, that, you know, the adventure's coming through here every week. You know, who's coming to the station? And once the wormhole became really active, what's coming out of the wormhole? But then you had, you know, I'm kind of a politics junkie. So the whole stuff with Bajor, and how it was rebuilding after the occupation, and, you know, the provisional government. This was all just sucking me in, and loved that part of it.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the influences for DS9 was a show called The Rifleman, which was a Western, I believe.
Yeah, that was the concept, for DS9, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It was about a man and his son in the Old West town, so it's very much like Sisko and Jake in that case.
Every time I watch Emissary, I think I like it a considerable bit more than I did the last time I watched it. And this time, I was really connecting with it. And as you say, it's very much a character show. And I think what I really like is that even though we're spending, you know, an hour and a half with these characters, I feel like there's somewhere for each and every one of them to go. You know, at the end of Farpoint, you're like, oh, great, he's Pinocchio, or oh, great, he's a commander who's Jim Kirk. Or, oh, great, he's a negotiator. Whereas this one, you've got Kira, who has so many conflicting emotions. She's got the conflict with the government. She's got conflict with Sisko. She's got a relationship with Odo going into the past. You've got Odo, who apparently has so much history and wants to know what's going on. None of these people you feel like was able to be encapsulated in this episode, which is a huge difference from DS9, or from TNG, I should say, and certainly from Voyager as well. And I think that's the main reason I connected with Emissary this time.
Yeah, that's what I told you when I said, why don't we do Emissary, was that, you know, I've watched Emissary so many times over the years, but I watched it again recently and also connected with it so much more than I did in the past. And pretty much the same thing. You know, every time I watch it, I see more and more things in it that make me like this episode more and more. And I've often said that I thought that Broken Bow is probably the best pilot episode of any Star Trek series. Mm-hmm. But right up there with that, I think, is Emissary. And after watching Emissary a few more times over the past week, I might, as far as the story goes, I would probably go with Emissary. As far as the production value overall goes, yeah, I still kind of prefer Broken Bow in that case, but yeah.
Yeah, I'd probably say that. I don't know. I'm not quite ready to put Emissary above Broken Bow because it's just so good. And I do actually like the characters on Enterprise as well and how they're set up in that pilot. But nevertheless, this really does set it up well. I think part of my problem with the show is I believe Ben was talking about the theme song and the whole opening credits. It's really boring.
Yeah.
It's like, look at this station sitting there in space. You know, they should be showing shots like inside the station, show the bustling activity, have some Dabo girls, show Sisko in ops. That's what they should be showing, not outside of the ship. Because the outside of the ship is just, or the station, it's not important.
So at the very
it's
end,
just, it, that's not the point.
After the wormhole bursts open, they should cut to some girls going, Dabo!
Exactly.
And then fade to
black. I was thinking more, it could be more of an opening like the old Vegas show. So you could have like Star Trek Vegas. With
yeah.
You have got the Dabo girls, you've got the lights, you've got the adventure, somebody getting shot. You know, Avery Brooks has to jump out and you know, cold cock somebody from, you know, out of nowhere, take him down. It could work.
Yeah, I mean, have somebody do a barrel roll.
I guess it would have reflected more of the action-packed nature that DS9 became,
yeah,
although
exactly.
It wasn't necessarily so action-packed in the very beginning.
I guess I have to throw myself out there and say I guess I'm the only one on this podcast that actually likes the theme song. I have it on iPod. I've always liked it.
I like the theme song from the beginning, but I'm also a bass trombonist. So for me, the whole orchestral feel of that theme song was great. And I liked the fact that it was slower. I've changed my mind over the years, but I did not like the peppier version that they came up with in season 4 when Worf came on the show. Is that Craig's 76 trombones or what you're saying there?
I mean, I like both versions, but I never really had a problem with the theme.
I think the peppier version ended up being very appropriate for Deep Space Nine, the way that the series unfolded. But I did like the slower version. Now with Enterprise, I still don't like the peppy version.
Yeah, I was gonna say it could be worse.
Well, I like the Enterprise song, but I like the original version,
right?
Not the peppy version. Yeah,
the original Enterprise theme is fantastic.
There's a way to do peppy right, and there's a way to do peppy wrong.
Yeah. So yes, so Ben, could you sing for us the theme song that you would have liked to have had for Deep Space Nine?
It's just something a little faster. I mean, I don't know, a little more of a higher tempo.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe something from the War of 1812 type, the overture.
I wouldn't mind something more like Old West themed, you know, something like the Firefly music.
Yeah, cowboys in space will never work.
Exactly.
I was hearing the Bonanza theme in my head there.
In a way, though, I kind of think that the original theme song, the slow version that we get in this episode, kind of works for setting up the show, because supposedly Deep Space Nine takes place is in the farthest reaches of the Federation, and they're kind of by themselves. They really have no one to rely on. So I think the theme, the original theme, kind of reflects that feeling of solitude.
Something I didn't notice until I had watched this episode again, and Memory Alpha mentioned it, that the opening credits didn't include the wormhole.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome.
On the first episode, until it was discovered.
The very first time. It was supposed to be a surprise.
Yeah, that's really cool.
The very first episode did not include the wormhole. I thought that was very cool that they kept that secret there. I mean, it's an obvious thing to do creatively, but at the same time, it's also something that it could be easy to just slap together the sequence that you're going to use for the series and just throw it in. So it was a nice little touch to keep that hidden until the end.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk about the actual concept of the show a little bit? And again, this was kind of the controversial thing when it came out, because it was played up as, you know, this darker Star Trek. And I don't think it's so much darker, though. But what it did is that it introduced diversity and conflict into Star Trek. You know, the Next Generation, everyone on the crew gets along so well. And there's not much diversity on the Enterprise crew either. I mean, Troy is half Betazoid, but she looks like a human. And, I mean, you've got Worf, who is a Klingon, but he grew up in the Ukraine. So, you know, he's also kind of has his own earthly origins as well. But so here you actually truly have diversity, and you've set up conflict where everyone's not going to get along with one another. And you even start off with a Starfleet commander who does not idolize Jean-Luc Picard, but rather goes in and tells Picard to kind of go screw himself, basically. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a great break from what we saw before.
I think one of the best things they did about this cast is that half of them aren't even Starfleet. That's another thing we haven't seen before.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird when you look at Ops and you realize it's not all Starfleet uniforms. Because like I said, I've been, you know, really hitting the TNG really hard, just injecting it directly. And it's all Starfleet uniforms. And it's just to finally break out of that and wow, these people aren't wearing the uniforms. Like, Kira is just wearing some other uniform and she's not a guest star. She's going to be there week after week, giving orders to people with Starfleet uniforms. That's really fantastic, and shows that the Federation isn't just humans, isn't just Starfleet. They're willing to be more open and more diverse.
Right.
And Quark is a great introduction as well, because you finally have someone who's not going to follow the rules. You know, I don't know, maybe on the Enterprise, you know, maybe Mott was have chicken fights or stuff in the holodecks that we didn't know about, that Picard had to kind of police. But here you finally have someone who really is going to create problems that go against the Federation ideals, you know, that we're used to, and that Sisko is going to have to deal with. But then you've also got the person who really has to deal with it is Odo, who's also not Starfleet. And Odo he's going to kind of go along with whatever happens to be the status quo at the station at the time, whether it's Cardassian law, whether it's Federation law, it's kind of whatever goes.
Right. His main concern is justice. And as long as he feels that justice is being served, he'll obey whoever's delivering it.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Basically.
Yeah. I like the storyline where Sisko has to convince Quark to stay. It would be very much it's a trope as far as an Old West story goes. But this isn't the Old West. This is science fiction. And bringing those two things together in a very solid Old West trope into science fiction is really cool. And I love the way it actually works.
Right. Community leader.
Yes.
I love his laugh, too.
I was going to try to make some political posters with Quark as, you know, mentioning his community leader background and then running for president, but I didn't know if that would work out too well.
But, you know, talking about Quark, finally someone who single-handedly, along with, you know, his other Ferengi family, finally made the Ferengi a three-dimensional species.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, oh, the Ferengi had it rough for the first six seasons as leading up to this. Although Rascals, they took over the Enterprise just all by themselves, like a group of like six Ferengi. So they finally got threatening, and then we're right back into comedic for the client, for the Ferengi. But I really think Quark works. He's really fantastic. I always forget that he wasn't on Next Gen. That he was
kind
created.
Of was,
yeah,
but he though, kind of was.
Yeah. That, yeah.
Actually, Armin Shimerman had. Well, I say he had a hand. I think it was really the fault of the director, but he was involved in the wrecking of the Ferengi concept right out of the gate for the next generation.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
But he fully admits to that. Yeah, yeah. He's not proud of it.
Right. Well, and I think that's also, and it's a bit of a retcon, but you can explain that the Ferengi spent those 6 years figuring out what they had to do to actually make a profit. Like, they still thought gold mattered in the first season. But by this time, they'd realized gold no longer had value.
It was like a six-year conference going on Ferenginar,
exactly.
Where all these Ferengi who we saw in the Next Generation got together in one room, and they're like, we're not leaving here until we figure out how to make a profit, because this gold thing is just not really working for us.
Yes.
We tried to be we tried to be scary. That didn't quite work out so well. Tried to like take over the ships. That didn't work out so well
just
either.
Just because you have sharp teeth doesn't mean you're scary.
Right.
But we have whips.
I just feel like they put the whips up to a vote, yay or nay. They put the fur coats up to a vote. They jumping around like monkeys. Rat monkeys. And all these things got voted down. And I think the Ferengi are much better off.
They came out and they said, you know, I think our strength is commerce. Let's get rid of the whips. Let's get rid of the leather and the fur. And let's open a bar. And
yes. The whole dominatrix thing just wasn't working for us.
Pretty much.
Oh, so isn't that the fallback job though? Is bartender? Like you lose your main job, your regular day job. It's like, well, I could tend bar for a while till I can do something else. If you're going through college, it works. But I mean, Quark is basically all Ferengi have now gone to bartending because their prime goal of being the arch nemesis of TNG failed. They're all unemployed. They're it's like, well, I can tend bar for a while, until we get this whole nemesis thing back.
Exactly. If we can't beat them, we'll serve drinks to them, pretty much, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
We'll water down the drinks. That'll get them.
And we'll keep them distracted with sexy holosuite programs.
Oh, the holosuites. What is the difference between a holosuite and the holodeck? Is it just that only one person can go in at a time?
No, you can have multiple people in the holosuites. Yeah. Because later in the seasons, one of Sisko's old classmates from the academy shows up, and they have like a baseball game.
The baseball episode.
The crew versus crew.
Well, that's true. Oh, and then there's the scene where Riker, not Riker, but Worf and somebody does his whole... his fighting program, and that's with somebody else. Maybe they can link the holosuites together.
Maybe. Well,
but I do like that they don't have a holodeck. Yeah, they're just holosuites.
Yeah, I mean, Worf and Jadzia are fighting in there all the time. Right. So
there we go. That's right. Yeah. Quote fighting.
Yes.
Right.
and Miles and Bashir, they go in there and they reenact their famous historical battles as well. So I don't know. I mean, I get the feeling, even the holo suite on the Enterprise is pretty small room for what goes on. So I get the feeling that you could have like a holo closet in your house in the 24th century where you just kind of step in the closet and then you are in this enormous world where I don't know how that works.
Well, that's what they have on Community. I don't know if any of our listeners are Community, but they have the Imaginarium, which is basically a closet-sized holodeck. It's pretty awesome.
Right.
Well, that was the second bedroom that they didn't want to get.
That's it.
I think the basic difference is that on the holo deck, only dirty things happen in programs created by Riker. But in the holo suites, dirty things openly happen. It's kind of like a selling point of the holo suite.
Pretty much.
Where else would you run? Where else would you run a program called Vulcan Love Slave?
Exactly. That's right. All right, exactly. But I think the concept, was really excellent, the diversity and the conflict. And another thing definitely. That we were talking about on the other side of the room was the how this falls within the Next Generation timeline, and it kind of like smoothly works its way in.
Right, because this was right after Chain of... If you go by Stardates, it was right after Chain of Command Part 1 and 2. which was the Picard is captured by the Cardassians. There are four lights, you know, that whole thing. Right. And it was right before Ship in a Bottle, which was the return of Moriarty.
Right.
Right.
So
and that's where it aired too. It was January, like the end of December in 1992 is when they aired Chain of Command.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started up the new year with DS9. Was Emissary and Ship in the Bottle the same week?
I do not.
As far as
know.
Aaron?
I'm not positive about.
I want to say Emissary. If I remember, Emissary aired like just after New Year's Day.
Yeah, it was
Day
on the 3rd of January. Yeah,
right.
Right.
Which was kind of interesting because I feel like these days they would not launch a series 2 days after New Year's like that.
No.
But yeah, then right. it was a huge thing. I remember the build up to it. I remember everyone getting together in bars, to watch the premiere of this new Star Trek series. I mean, it was at the time anyway, I believe it was the high, and for a long time after, the highest rated syndicated premiere ever. And I imagine that's probably been trumped by now. I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, it was a huge event.
Well, that was the thing is back when TNG and DS9 were first coming on, the whole idea of original content for syndicated distribution, it was almost a joke. I mean, it was never something, you know, that was going to be big numbers. But TNG was routinely pushing, you know, network programming off the air. So, you know, when DS9 comes along, you're thinking, okay, this is going to be the next great thing. So I can see that they would have big numbers for the premiere.
Yeah, that was a build-up.
Especially in that time
frame. Because in 94, right. 94 was when Next Generation was actually nominated for Best Drama Series in the Emmys,
right.
along with the X-Files, which I think is a rare case when even one science fiction series gets nominated for Best Drama, much less two.
Definitely. Yeah, so. But, I mean, you can really tell they sunk big bucks into this. I mean, just the opening battle with... I mean, they didn't even show the Battle of Wolf 359 in TNG. It's sort of just talked about. Or they might hear it through audio channels.
Right.
So they show that battle. They build all of these sets. I mean, the promenade set, Ops, Quark's Bar, the runabout. There's all of these like digital effects that are going on as well with blue screens. This has to be up there in one of the most expensive Trek episodes from the 80s and 90s.
I would imagine so. I would say that even though TNG doesn't look cheap necessarily, but there's only so much that they do as effects wise. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, Greg. I think that this is the first time that Paramount or whoever is starting to throw money at the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it really felt like. Right.
I think it's not just money though. This came along at the time when doing those types of effects had become a bit more economical to do. I mean, it was feasible. The battle of Wolf 359, I have a feeling at the time that The Best of Both Worlds was produced, it would probably have just broken the bank to try to do the battle that they did in Emissary at that point in time. So I think they did decide to throw a lot of money at this episode, but they were also able to do so much more with that money as well. So it was good timing for this series to start to explore more visuals in that way.
I thought it was hilarious that I think it's Bashir and Dax come aboard DS9 on a Daedalus class starship.
Oberth.
I mean the Oberth class. Because that's the ship they use so much in TNG. It's like whatever ship it is just happens to be Oberth class because that's the one model they have that doesn't and they can damage it and then fix it up for next week.
That was the Grissom from Star Trek 2, right? Was a
3.
Star Trek 3. 3.
Oh, that's 3. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so that was that one. Oh, speaking of Bashir, okay, one thing I do want to talk about here are some of the characters. Now, Bashir in this episode, am I the only one who just absolutely hates Bashir the way he was presented at the beginning?
You're not the only Star Trek fans that felt that way, apparently. And it's hard not to take a disliking to him, especially in these early seasons, because he's so green, but so... Like, he puts Kirk to shame sometimes in how arrogant he can act.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I like Bashir a bit more than I should, just because he's wearing that awesome blue, like, that science uniform that I love. When he first shows up, he has the TNG-style bright blue science uniform, and I want one of those really bad. And for some reason, watching this episode, I didn't hate Bashir, and I don't know why, because I know in a few episodes, I am really going to start despising him. There's a few episodes coming up in the first season where he's just a complete ass. And right. This one, I kind of see where he's coming from. You know, he's fresh. He's fresh-faced. He does want to be a hero. He wants to be out there on the frontier. And I totally see where he's coming from.
He certainly doesn't make the best impression with Major Kira.
No, that's for sure.
No.
I don't know.
Or yeah, Dax, for that matter.
Well, Dax agreed to go out with him, which she never does later on. So,
yes.
She was placating him, I guess. Let's be honest.
Yes, she was.
I just thought... some of the characters were so richly written in Emissary, Sisko and Kira in particular, that I felt like Bashir was written. He was just a really, really two-dimensional, oh, look at me. I just got out of the academy, and I'm in the wilderness, and woohoo kind of character. Right?
And to borrow a phrase from my show, he's suffering from a major... you know, overdose of PDH syndrome.
Right.
And as you look back at him now, when we know how Bashir developed, and we know later that he became genetically enhanced, or he was genetically enhanced, the problem is at this point, the whole idea of him being genetically enhanced, I think, was not something that anyone had thought of, even the writers. So he's just coming across as a giant ass, basically, right here. You know, the arrogance is not backed by the fact that he's actually smarter than everyone else. That's a Bashir there. Now, Ben, I do have to ask you, though, with Bashir, because he's a doctor, if you were injured and you might possibly die, would you feel more comfortable in the hands of Dr. Bashir or Dr. Crusher?
Bashir, hands down. I mean, I don't care if the doctor treating me is an arrogant ass, as long as he is an actual doctor with a success rate. He has a history of not killing his patients by, you know, using the good old country medicine of, I'll just let him lay there for a while. I'm sure he could get better.
Man.
And the empty hypo spray.
I just watched the episode.
Yes.
I watched the episode where Worf's back was crushed by a styrofoam drum. Right. And... he's just sort of laying there, and there's a scene where Crusher tells Picard,
oh, no,
there's some things I can't fix. I can't fix certain things, like paralysis and gunshot wounds and the sniffles.
Paper cuts. Oh.
The sad thing is, before I started listening to Dork Trek, I really liked Crusher.
Yeah, I know.
I still like her.
But yeah, that's the sad thing. The sad thing for me is before I started, you know, being on Dork Trek, I hated Pulaski. And thought Crusher was great. But now I've completely reversed on that.
Well, I still hate Pulaski, but you're making the case for Crusher really not that good. Yeah. I'm sorry to say.
But yeah. But Bashir does seem to be at least competent. I mean, he rushes down when they get attacked.
Well,
and he
actually, no, he doesn't.
People.
He doesn't rush down when they get attacked. Odo says, "Where is that doctor of yours?" And then it's like the light comes on in Bashir that, like, wait a minute, I am a doctor.
I'm a doctor.
I am here to help people. We are under attack.
He gets that expression on his face. I'm on my way.
You know, before that, it's like he's sitting there and he's like, oh, Jadzia, you're so pretty when you're working those controls when we're in danger. And then he snaps out of it, wait a minute, I am here to help people.
I will say, once he does go into triage mode and he's there barking orders to Odo, he's on the money. He's got it.
Yeah.
That was a kind of a nice flashback to the original MASH movie, I thought. And I saw that mentioned online, too. Because, I cannot ever say the actor's name who plays Odo, because I always refer to him as Clayton Endicott III, which was his character on Benson. But he was Father Mulcahy in the original MASH movie.
That's right.
And there was a similar scene where a doctor told him to, you know, just put pressure there. And, the soldier's bleeding in a neck wound and he's having to hold pressure. So I don't know if the writers intentionally did that or if it was just by happenstance or something. Or if he remembered, 30 years ago I did a scene just like this. Let me do it that way.
That's quite possible. Never put that together.
Yeah, I never made
awesome.
That connection. But, that's quite possible. That's very cool. Yeah.
That's very cool.
Well, talking about other characters, of course, this episode really centers around Sisko, and there are kind of two mm-hmm. facets, both to the setup of Deep Space Nine and to the character of Sisko. The introduction of religion in Deep Space Nine was something that I think was a very good move. Now, I'm personally not a religious person, but religion is very much a part of reality, and it's a part of people's lives. And as much as Gene Roddenberry wanted to think that religion would be gone by the 24th century, you know, I don't know if it will or not. And even if it is for humans, it doesn't mean that that's the case for every culture right. that we might encounter in space. So I love the fact that they introduced a civilization in the Bajorans who are people who are going to be an integral part of this series all the way through to the end, for whom the very foundation of what they of their culture is based on their religion, mm-hmm. and that we would have a captain who becomes a religious figure for them. It's so not mm-hmm. Star Trek and yeah. Prior to that, right? At the same time, I think it's completely Star Trek in the fact that it allows us to delve into the, you know, deeper threads within our society.
Well, one thing I find really interesting about Sisko here in this first episode is how he's exploring. Like he enters this whole new space. Picard doesn't do that. Picard runs the ship. Everywhere he goes, people are saluting. Everyone knows who he is. Whereas Sisko, I feel like Sisko is actually like an RPG character. And he's entering this new game world. And what always reminds me of this is when he walks by the temple and the Bajoran guy comes out and says, you know, hello, would you like to come inside? And every time I feel like that's like a side quest. You know, he's got his main quest he's on and that's a side quest. And he has to choose his response. And it's like, well, no, not now. And then he plays the game, you know, for another couple hours and gets to the point where it's like, well, no, now you need to go on the side quest. But it's still, what's cool about that is Sisko doesn't rule. Like, he doesn't know every nook and cranny of the promenade. He's exploring this world just like we are. Yeah. And that's much more interesting, I think, than Picard. You know, you can never put yourself in Picard's shoes, I feel like. But Sisko, I'm right there trying to figure it out. I want to know what's going on with the prophets because obviously it's something that affects Sisko personally and directly, and that means I care too. And that's cool to have that sort of personal connection with the quote captain.
You know, you mentioned this, Greg, and I never really thought of it before, but for the first hour of this series or of this show, Sisko is our point of view as the audience. We are being mm-hmm. introduced to this world through Sisko. And I never really thought of it that way, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah, and I feel like he's even there with us. Oh, what's this? This is a space station in the middle of nowhere. Why would I watch this show?
His attitude kind of reflects, I guess, what Star Trek fans may have been feeling at the time. Yeah. Is like, I don't even want this posting. Send me back to Earth.
Right. Yeah. Give me a starship. Give me a 5-year mission. That's what I really want. That's what's interesting about being a Starfleet, about watching a Star Trek show. But then The whole show is designed to explain to Sisko and to us as a viewer why this can actually be kind of interesting.
Absolutely.
You know, the whole thing with the prophet as he's going down, you mentioned Greg at the beginning, mm-hmm. was, again, I don't know to what extent the writers had really thought ahead as to where Sisko was going in terms of, I mean, they had the idea that he's the emissary, you know, he's the person that has been foretold in the Bajoran religious texts who would someday come to kind of save the people, I guess, in a way. And but that prophet, it's not even like he's seeing a new person walk by and he's saying, oh, would you like to come in and check out the temple? It's like he was waiting for Sisko all this time, mm-hmm. and there's Sisko. Mm-hmm. And the connection between that moment, which happens just very early in Emissary, to the end in What You Leave Behind and the journey that Sisko went on. I mean, it was just set up so well.
And that was one of my questions about the whole series was, how much did they know in the beginning going into it? Because there's so many elements that you're going to see for the next 7 years of this show, the next 7 seasons, that are, you know, initially brought up in this first episode. or the first two, depending on how you watch it. But
well, it aired as one episode, so I always think of it as one. And yeah, you're right. Yeah. I mean, it's what you notice. The thing is, with this episode, they set up Kira's background very well. They set up Sisko as the kind of unwilling religious figure to the Bajorans. They set up the whole Bajoran-Cardassian conflict within the crew. Then suddenly, for a few more after that, we kind of get into these like next generation type bottle shows through the first scene of DS9, which makes me wonder, like, how much plan did they have going in or not? Because they set everything up in Emissary so well to tell this whole extremely complex story over seven seasons, but they didn't really get into telling that story until they were on into the second season, moving on to the third season. But it all ties back together so well.
Yeah. Well, part of me wonders if that some of those first season episodes were studio mandated, like, you know, we have to bring the next geners over to Deep Space Nine, and we can't throw them into the middle of this story if they didn't watch the pilot and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, I don't know if I agree with, but I can only imagine that was the studio mentality at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. I always kind of felt like they knew they had a new concept on their hands and they weren't quite sure yet how they were going to make it work within Star Trek. And then also maybe they had some trepidation about how fans would accept it. So they kind of eased into it a little bit.
I think part of that is just the writer's room coming together. You know, I imagine Emissary was done pretty much Pillar and Berman together, just working together long nights, figuring out this show, figuring out where they want it to go. But then when you get into the first eight episodes, those are going to be farmed out. You know, maybe the whole room comes up with the concept, but then they're giving it to somebody and saying, write this episode. So they're just not going to have the same amount of care that the first episode we're going to have. And they're not also going to look like Next Gen Season 6, which by that time, everybody in the room knew what all the characters sounded like, what the strong suits of the show were. It was just trying and trying and trying for that first little bit. And that's always the thing with a show like this, where you don't know. Like, no one knows what sort of show is going to work well for DS9, because no one's ever done a show like this before. So you've got to try a whole bunch of different things. You know, you've got to try a board game on the holodeck or whatever that one episode was, because maybe that's the sort of show that's going to work really well for DS9. You don't know until you try it.
Right, I think the same thing goes for Q. Maybe let's try Q and bring in Q and see how he works with the DS9 people.
Yeah, that is one of my favorite scenes, I think, in all of DS9, is the first meeting between Q and Benjamin Sisko.
The boxing match?
Oh, it's the boxing match when he says, you know, Picard never hit me.
I'm not Picard.
I'm not Picard. And I think that was a message to the fans, too, of, I am a completely different, you know, commander. I do things... Yeah. A whole new style.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about Sisko as a character, I always thought as the series went on, Sisko was a perfect blending for me of the thoughtfulness and the cerebralness of Picard. But when the action, when it was time for action, he had the fire and the spirit of Kirk.
You could say that. Definitely there. But at the same time, Sisko, for me, is very much his own character.
I'm not trying to say he's a melding of the two captains. I'm just saying, you know, there are things about his character that remind me a little bit of the other captains, but he's his own animal, and he makes his impression in the Star Trek series in a fantastic way.
Yeah, because sometimes you see cases where the writers, they decide, like, oh, this character worked in this series, and this one worked, and they, like, try to recreate that character. That happens sometimes. In this case, I think Sisko is like one of the great creations of Deep Space Nine and of Star Trek.
It almost doesn't even matter what the writers did with Sisko. Avery Brooks was going to bring his own Avery Brooksisms to the show. You know, I doubt that was scripted. I know. I don't think that was there.
Anyway, Ben, didn't you want to talk about that part for a second?
That almost turned me against the show. It really did. When I was first watching this, you know, back in the 90s, And my best friend and I remember we, you know, met at my grandmother's house to watch it, you know, on the old, you know, antenna TV and everything. And he hits that, and for, you know, like a week later, that we'd see each other in the halls at school and just go, ow! You know? So I, is this what this is going to be? I mean, he didn't do that when he was a man called Hawk. He didn't do that on Spencer for Hire. Why is he doing it? Is it the hair? Is the hair making him do that?
Is he going to walk into Ops all of a sudden and go, Jedzia, you know?
But, I mean, and there's several, I don't know what it was with his vocal patterns, where I wanted to initially say Kirk-like, but it wasn't even Kirk-like when he would get mad and he would start with the talking and I have to get this point out now.
Yes.
No, Avery, this series convinced me that Avery Brooks is a very, very angry man when he wants to be.
When he wants to be, sure. Maybe. He can.
I don't know. I don't use the word angry. Yeah. I think he's a very passionate man. That's what I get any time I hear him speak, yeah.
I'll say this much. If there's any captain that I would least want to be dressed down by, it would be Sisko.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
I just recently watched a past tense episode where it covers the bell riots in the early 21st century. And, you know, our characters get tossed back there and deal with it. And, you know, Sisko is heavily involved with that, of course. But there are some scenes there where, just like Matt was saying, this is not the guy I want mad at me. I mean, if you're the ensign that messes up, I don't need this commander coming at me and, you know, reading me the riot act.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and none of the other, I think we talked about this when we did past tense, none of the other captains could have done that. You know, imagine Janeway trying to be involved in the riots. Like, she's just not going to, she's not going to do it. Picard is just going to try to negotiate his way out of it.
Janeway would have blown her cover right away, as you well know.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Immediately.
Especially if Harry had been the one with her. He would have Harry never thought on his feet to say, oh yeah, I'm Gabriel Bell. He would have said,
right,
I'm Ensign Harry Kim of the Starship Voyager. Yes. Immediately. So.
And that's why you're in the Sanctuary District.
That's right.
Right, exactly.
He'd be like, why do all these uniforms have PDH on them? What does that stand for?
Right.
Oh,
but I don't know. Does Sisko kind of tones down the Avery Brooksism for a little while, doesn't he? I feel like after Emissary, there's not quite as much of that.
I think
until maybe the third or fourth season.
I think the directors and producers kind of made some adjustments to his character after the pilot episode because they felt it was not quite what they were going for.
Yeah.
But I totally disagree. You know, the Sisko that we get from like season four onward, when he's actually a captain, the Sisko that we get like in the Pale Moonlight, for example, going all through there, that is exactly the character that you need in the situation that they have on Deep Space Nine and what's going on. You know, I've said before that none of the other captains could run that space station. You have to be that type of character that Sisko is. And I think Avery Brooks played Sisko very, very well in Emissary. And then Sisko kind of became a little bit less interesting and kind of the standard Starfleet commander for a little while. And then he became more Avery Brooks again. And that's the Sisko that I love.
To adopt one of your euphemisms, he grew the beard and then he became Sisko.
Well, actually, he not only grew the beard, he shaved the head.
Yeah.
That's the key for DS9.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't able to go to the full Riker. So, you know, with only the goatee, then you have to balance that out with the shaved head.
Well, that is one. No one wears a goatee like Avery Brooks.
Definitely. Exactly.
No. I would not want to have a Sisko with a full Riker beard. No,
it just wouldn't work
for me. No. While we're talking about hair, though, can I point out just one scene that I thought was really odd? And if I had been involved in the production of this episode and casting, I would have said, wait a minute, guys, we have got to choose. There are 1,014 people on the Enterprise. There's got to be somebody else on the bridge when O'Brien goes in to look at the bridge for the last time. Why is O'Brien talking to himself on the bridge?
I was thinking, not that particularly, but yes, who is that and why does she look so much like O'Brien?
They have exactly the same hairstyle.
Yes, this is true.
It could be like a cousin or a, you know, maybe even his kid's sister or something we didn't know. She flew in from Dublin. You know, she just got out of the academy.
Yeah.
And I guess
you could only have so many O'Briens per ship. And now that he was leaving, she's able to come aboard.
Maybe. She's taking over
with
for
the addition
him.
Of little Molly, that was one O'Brien too many, and so out they had to go.
Yes, that's the problem.
We've hit the quota. You're out. There can only be so many Irish on the ship.
Every time I see this episode, though, I think, could you just have done something else with her hair? Because it really looks like O'Brien's talking to O'Brien.
Wow, man.
All right. Well, we talked a lot about Sisko. To hit on a few more characters, Kira, for one, is one of the shining moments of... I know I hear a lot of people who don't like Kira, but I love the fact that they had a first officer who is not a Starfleet officer, who doesn't want the Federation to be there, and is very, very passionate about something that she believes in that conflicts with what we normally think of as the ideals of Star Trek.
I mean, talk about a great introduction to a character, her screaming at the view screen, "You're being a fool, well then don't ask my opinion next time," you know? And she,
Yeah, that was a really great scene, and then her conflict with Sisko. And then also the scene where she confronts the Cardassians on the warships is just so good. I mean, imagine Chakotay standing up to Cardassians like that. It's just not going to happen.
No.
But she looks in their eyes and she makes them believe that she would die for her cause.
Right.
And it's just, wow, that's who Kira is. And that's, that's a character I want to know more about. Let me see more stories about Kira.
Also, too, this is the first time we've had a main character who kind of, when she's introduced, she doesn't bow before, you know, the quote-unquote mighty Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Like, this is the first time, I think, in Star Trek where the idea of, oh, the Federation's not all that awesome, you know, or someone thinks that the Federation's not all that awesome, who's not the Klingons or the Romulans.
Yeah. Yeah, if Sisko had asked her to manually dock the saucer section, she would have told him where he could go stick it.
That's true.
Well, I think, though, that was interesting, just with Kira and Odo, their first interaction with Sisko. I mean, Kira was, "So I guess you want the office." And Odo's was, "Who the hell are you?
Who the hell are you?"
Oh, yes. I know. I love that, too. That was, both of them. The way that they greeted Sisko, especially Odo, too. It's like, "I don't care if you're the commander of the station." Because Kira says, "This is our new Starfleet commander." And Odo says, "I don't allow phasers on the promenade." It's like, "I don't care if you're my commander. You're going to follow my rules. You're on my station now, Mr. Starfleet man."
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And do we have any idea what the story would have been had they convinced Michelle Forbes to do Ensign Row? Like, was she going to leave the Federation to join the battle? Do we have any idea where that was going?
I'm not sure. Do you know, Ben? Because you seem to be the...
No, I... You know, that was one thing that boggled me, is because she had the part. I mean, this was Michelle Forbes. They basically built this series and said, "Hey, we'll put it at Bajor. You know, we've got this whole Bajoran storyline going now with Ensign Ro. We're going to bring her over. She'll be the first officer of this, you know, space station. It'll be great. You'll love it." I mean, she just didn't want to sign a 6-year contract. And I don't know. I've got a friend who's kind of like a starving actor who will jump at any part he can get. It must be nice when you think of yourself, you know, good enough that, it's a 6-year deal. Forget it. I'll focus on movies like Will Wheaton did. It's turning out so well for him. So in story, I'm not really sure how they would have brought that back around for her to, you know.
I can't see it working.
As much as I love Ensign Ro, and I do love Ensign Ro, I think it was so important that this first officer, this Bajoran liaison officer, needed to not be a member of Starfleet. She needed to butt heads with Sisko. And even though Ensign Ro did butt heads with the Enterprise crew, by this time in the series, she's kind of become a bit more Starfleetized, so to speak. I mean, she's kind of back in line. She's following orders. She may grumble a little bit, but she kind of goes along with what, you know, Captain Picard tells her to do. And I think it's so important in that first scene for Kira to be like, you know, "I don't think that the Federation has any business being here."
No, but we're here to help.
Right.
Yeah, I can't see it working with Ro. I just can't see Ro having the passion that Kira has that was so important to the character and important for establishing who the Bajorans were, because, you know, sure, we see Kaiopaka, we see Vedic Burrell, we see the always lovely Kai Winn as the series goes on.
By the way, they couldn't, but still, you have to admit, they couldn't have gotten a better actress for that part
than Kai Winn.
For Louise Fletcher. I mean,
oh God, she's hate like, Kai Winn.
Her name is like synonymous with bitch, you know?
I mean, right. I think that's, you know, something that speaks to, the quality of the actress, like Matt's saying, is that for me to still, after all these years, cannot stand, and if I see her in anything else, I immediately have that twinge of, I don't like you.
Right.
That's true.
Just because of the years on DS9.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're Nurse Ratched and Kai Winn. You are the most hated person on the planet.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Well, I was going to say, we see all these people, but what really makes the Bajoran people and their plight against the Cardassians and even their dedication to their religion, what makes it all very, very real for me, you know, more real than most anything that we've seen in Star Trek before, is Kira. And the way that Nana Visitor plays that part as well. And I just can't see Laren, Ensign Ro, whatever she would have become. Is she going to jump all the way up to be like Commander Ro or
Commander
something?
Ro.
I don't know.
Well, she'd be Lieutenant Commander Ro, maybe.
Maybe. And then she could be on Dork Trek. with you guys. I can't see her bringing the passion to that part that Kira did within the context of the story.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen Michelle Forbes, you know, she was on Battlestar in a very, very memorable role.
Yeah, she was very good on Battlestar, yeah.
So say we all!
So, I know Michelle Forbes could bring it.
Yes, yeah.
The question is, with where Ro was at in season 5 and 6, something would have had to happen with her character to make her as strong as Kira ended up being. And maybe if they did have her leave Starfleet and then maybe she was part of the war. I don't know. They would have had to do more to set it up.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I mean, it's like I said, she was already too Starfleetized at that point.
Right. I mean, she was on Rascals, like jumping up and down on the bed with Child Guinan.
Yes.
Like, that's not who you want to have staring down Cardassians.
And then a few episodes later, she's now the first officer of Space Nine, right? I totally agree. Michelle Forbes could have played the part and brought the passion to it, but the character of Ro wasn't there. And even if they did do something where she goes off and she's involved in the war now, what makes Kira work is that Kira was doing that since she was a child.
Yeah.
That was her life. That's what made it work. So I don't
see
how
the difference
Ro
between
worked.
Kira and Ro is that Ro left Bajor. She ran for the occupation. Right. Kira stuck it out and fought.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I'm absolutely fine with.
Is this not, though, the same thing as Tasha and her sister, where Tasha ran off to join Starfleet, but her sister stayed behind and worked her way up in the ranks of whatever cadre or, you know, type of government that they were building there?
Hmm.
So, I mean, you know, it's almost a parallel there.
Is interesting.
Yeah, that is true. I hadn't really thought about that. Yeah, it's a good parallel. That's why we need our TNG expert on the show.
Right. Well, another bit of trivia. I was talking with you guys before the show about Famke Janssen, who everyone remembers from the X-Men films, but she was also in the TNG episode The Perfect Mate. And she was actually who they were pursuing to play Dax, which is pretty much why Dax ends up having the same spots on her face that Famke had in The Perfect Mate. What do you guys think? Basically, Terry Farrell, Famke Janssen.
Mm.
Oh,
it's hard in hindsight.
Here's the thing. I've picked this up more as I've been on Star Trek fan boards. There seems to be a lot of Terry Farrell disdain, and I'm just going to go right up here and say it. As dynamic and interesting as all these characters are, Jadzia is my favorite character, and I can't imagine anyone else but Terry Farrell doing it. I mean, she just, you know, not so much in the first seasons because she kind of is feeling out the character, but once they introduce the whole Curzon, her past host, the romance with Worf, the Klingon aspect, I mean, I respect, my thing in sci-fi is I love women that can maintain their femininity, but kick ass and take names when they need to and step up to the plate. And she just embodied all that for me. So, and I'm sure Famke could have done a great job because she's done that in other roles. I mean, God, look at Xenia on a top. Mm-hmm. But for me personally, it's just hard to see anyone but Terry Farrell. I mean, she just made the character for me. She really did.
I mean, I'll be honest. When Becker premiered, which was after sixth season of DS9, Terry Farrell left to be a cast member on The Becker Show with Ted Danson. The only reason I was watching Becker was because Jadzia was now on Earth. I mean, that was it. That was my only, you know, and yeah, it was, you know, funny laugh, ha-ha, Ted Danson. Oh, yeah, you're mean. But it was the only thing that got my initial interest was Terry Farrell. So I really couldn't imagine at this point, I guess maybe after it's because it's just so burned in my head after 7 years of it.
Yeah.
Anybody else playing that part. I mean, she had a toughness about her, but at the same time, there was the soft side that just really came through. I mean, some of her more tender moments, you know, through the series that just, I don't know. I couldn't imagine Famke.
Agree. I cannot picture anyone else playing Jadzia Dax either.
The wonderful thing about this show, too, in the writing of the women characters specifically, I know, Ben, you talk about, you know, the way Troi and Crusher are written on TNG, and it's not a very good portrayal of women necessarily. But I think that with DS9 specifically, they were able to strike that wonderful balance of making the women tough, but at the same time not writing them as, you know, men with boobs. So to speak, you know, they were able to maintain their femininity, but they were able to step up when the going got tough, and they used their smarts to get out of situations. And sometimes they've resorted to fisticuffs and, you know, it was just a wonderful balance.
Well, I think that's a reflection of how the world was changing, though, because you have Crusher and Troi being written from that mid-80s, you know, point of view where, you know, you were still struggling with the whole feminism. You know, how much, you know, out there, you know, the women were what on Dynasty with the giant shoulder pads, you know, trying to look like linebackers
that
or
huge,
something.
That huge hair Crusher had in the first season.
Exactly. And then now you have DS9 coming out, which, you know, more or less is, you know, early, mid-90s. Now you're writing them. They're coming from the point of view of, I mean, what? Was this Murphy Brown era? This was, things like that. So the way society was looking at what was acceptable for women to be portrayed as, and then just women in general, what they were going to put up with had changed a lot in the, you know, what, the 6 years since TNG had first aired.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, you look at, I don't know, every time there's a TNG episode that focuses on Troi, it's like, I might as well just turn it off now. Because I'm going to be offended, I'm going to be bored, and I'm going to be laughing too much for this to be a good show, but not enough to really be enjoying myself. Whereas I feel like if you have a show about Dax, there's so many interesting stories to have about Dax. Like, I'm they can fail, they can have bad stories, but there's so much more to her. And the same is true with Kira. And it's just like, and I don't know if maybe they had more writers that were women, or maybe it was just that the culture sensibilities had changed. But they seemed so much more confident creating a fully realized female character.
Well, they also,
and I don't get the hate for Terry Farrell at all.
Well, they also set up both Kira and Dax as characters who had very rich backgrounds that they could build from, whereas Troi and Crusher were just stock characters to put on the ship basically at the beginning, and we don't really learn very much other than Crusher knew Picard for a long time, her husband's dead, she has a kid. That's basically all we know about her.
Pretty much who's the father?
And that's one of the great dynamics they introduced right here in this pilot is that, you know, I love the fact that Sisko and Jadzia or Sisko and Dax are old friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They set the series up so well with so many places that they could go. So. Yeah.
Well, and this is my absolute favorite part, and I think this probably gets us into the end. My favorite part of this episode is the time that Sisko spends with the prophets.
Yes.
Where yeah.
He's reliving his past, and he's reliving all of these scenes that we saw earlier in the episode. And it's just this amazing thing that culminates in him realizing that he still lives in this memory of his wife dying that we saw at the very opening. And wow, that's something. I mean, Picard, especially at the beginning of TNG, there's nothing like that in Picard's past. No. You know, maybe eventually he gets, you know, there's the best of both worlds. There's the inner light where he gets these things that really shape him as a person. But for the first 60 years of his life, he was just, you know, very model of a modern Starfleet captain. But Sisko, this guy's got issues, and yeah. So many issues that the prophets don't even know how to deal with them. They're like, who are you? What's going on? What are all these jumbled memories that you're still dealing with?
And you're pointing out one of my favorite things about this series, Greg, is that as much as I love Gene Roddenberry and the world that he created, I can identify with these characters specifically on DS9 more than I can with the TNG or the TOS characters, because these people have problems. They're flawed. Mm. They're selfish. They make decisions and they have to live with the consequences of those decisions. But in spite of all of that, they're still trying to be the best humans or the best people that they can possibly be. And I think for me, that's much more, I hesitate to use the word realistic, but it's much more, you know, I can accept that more than, you know, these perfect humans who never make any mistakes and, you know, never get anything wrong, so to speak.
Right. Well, yeah.
That's one of the things that I've taken flack for bringing up in the past, though, is that once Roddenberry became less involved with TNG, TNG got better.
Yeah.
Roddenberry was not, Roddenberry had already, I guess, passed on by the time DS9 was on the air.
It was right around, yes. Yeah, unification.
Right around that.
Right? Yeah.
91.
He died in during TNG's fifth season.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he.
Right. So he was not involved with this at all. And we see how it turns out. I mean, you know, right off the bat, you have, I mean, some super well-written, rounded-out characters. And it takes a couple of years to get its footing. But it just doesn't seem to have that, in the future, everybody gets along and the Federation is happy and we don't use money and we have a utopian society. And right. By getting away from Gene's vision, but not totally. I mean, there's still that promise of hope for the future. Mm-hmm. But yeah, right. Out on the edges, people don't like each other. You know, you've got all these quarreling people. And they still try to follow the Roddenberry rule where, Starfleet gets along with each other. But that doesn't, you know, we can have conflict with the Bajorans, the little personal relationships. You can have an argument with the Ferengi guy. Yeah, you can do that. But it just seemed like the less involved, and it's like the Star Wars movies with Lucas, where, you know, you have so much hate for the prequels that he was almost totally in, you know, control of. In my opinion, the best Star Wars movie was Empire, which he had the least control of.
Yeah,
right.
And so I wonder if Star Trek suffered from that same thing where, yeah, Gene came up with a great idea, but, you know, and it succeeded in spite of him.
That's interesting. Yeah. You know, I'm very interested to hear someone like you, Ben, who I know is very beholden to the original series because it was part of your childhood. But I think you and I are on the same page in that I think that Gene Roddenberry is an amazing man. He's a great world creator. Like, he created this universe, definitely. And it's fantastic. But not necessarily the best writer. You know, writing a little bit flawed. So, you know, it's great that he created this world. It's great that he created this universe and these sorts of bodies in the Federation and all these other empires and whatnot. But people took... It really worked when people like Ronald D. Moore... And even, you know, Brannon Braga and Michael Piller took those principles, changed them up a bit, and ran with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's similar to you talk about Stan Lee in the original. You know, he's the one who created all these characters. But, I mean, people disagree about who the best author of Spider-Man was, but it wasn't Stan Lee. I'd say it was J. Michael Straczynski. It was when you got into the 80s and 90s, and these people who weren't beholden at all to Stan Lee started taking over. That's when these characters started really taking off in these worlds. But you needed that original idea to come from someone amazing like Gene Roddenberry, like George Lucas, like Stan Lee. But there's a point at which that person has to just let go and realize that the only way the world is going to really grow is when they let it into the hands of these other people.
And I'd even say that, you know, stuff like the way TOS and TNG were written were absolutely necessary for them to be written that way, because those two series set up this whole universe. And, you know, especially TNG, because DS9 takes place in the 24th century, TNG kind of sets up the universe for us and kind of lets us figure out, okay, this is the Federation. These are the Klingons of the century. These are the Romulans. These are the Cardassians. And, you know, like I said at the top of the show here, that needed to be established in its own series. So now that when DS9 comes along, we can say, okay, now that we have all these empires and, you know, bodies of power, let's actually dig it deep and explore them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like Ben, you know, I grew up with TOS, and TNG came along when I was in high school. And so it took me a little while to warm up to TNG as well, and TOS was my thing. And I think Gene Roddenberry had a wonderful vision of the future. It's always been an inspirational thing for me, and I really admire his vision of, you know, a utopian society and that we can overcome our problems and get there. But when you talk about doing a television show, I mean, what's interesting isn't that world. What's interesting is the journey to that world. And that's what his rules about no conflict and so forth, they make it difficult for you to write good drama. But telling the story of how we get from here to there, yes, there's going to be drama. There's going to be conflict along the way. That works. And that's where I think finally with DS9, they embraced it. But like you said, Matt, the stories that we get in DS9, especially in the latter seasons, wouldn't necessarily work as well if we didn't have the whole TNG background to know who all the players are, and we have backstories to all the players. Then it all works very well when you get into it.
That's the reason why I know, Ben, you guys just did the Wounded, which was the introduction of the Cardassians, which is absolutely necessary for TNG to do, because in this episode we get Gul Dukat, who, for me, he is the Cardassians as far as I'm concerned. Oh, yeah. And, you know, you can't bring in a great character like him if you don't already know who the Cardassians are to a certain extent.
Yeah, right. Right.
All right. Well, let's return to one last topic here before we wrap up. And that's the concept of time, again, because it is one of the...
Don't F with time.
That's right. So, I mean, for me, there are two parts of Emissary for me. There's the whole setup for the series, and then there's the actual... social commentary portion of it, which takes place in the wormhole with Sisko and the prophets. And I've always, since a child, been fascinated by time. And, you know, the idea that for us, time, it seems like it's an integral part of the universe, you know, every second, every minute, every hour of every day. Mm-hmm. And the years go by and so forth, you know, but in reality, it's all relative to where you are and how fast you're traveling and so forth. And there are even, you know, theoretically there can be universes in which the arrow is flipped the other way from what we're accustomed to. Mm-hmm. There's even the idea that before the Big Bang, there may have been no time because time was created. You know, the arrow of time was set as a result of that. So the idea that there are these aliens in this wormhole who live like outside of the grasp of time, and they have no concept of linear time is very fascinating. And it's something that we didn't really see before. You know, when Star Trek does time, it's always a time travel story in which history's been changed and our characters have to correct the problems so that they can still exist in the future. And so this was a very new take on time. And it's one that I always really connected with myself in thinking about what is time really, and how do we, the events in our lives, how do they actually fit into, you know, the bigger picture of the universe?
No, I agree. I mean, this is the first time where we really think of, as much as people would like to say that DS9 doesn't maintain the Roddenberry philosophy, it's the whole conversation and Sisko defending humanity in a sense to the prophets is done much better than even in, you know, I would even say Picard defending humanity to Q. But it's the first time in the Star Trek universe where we actually take a philosophical look back at you know, okay, we have these tragedies in our lives and we'd like to, we exist there. We'd like to try to forget them. We'd like to try to erase them. We would do anything to go back and you know, have them not happen. But what Sisko realizes and what all us as a species has to realize is that these bad things happen for a reason and they shape who we are today. And I think that's the first time in Star Trek, at least that I remember, where we say that a tragedy that happens to a character shapes who they are. And, you know, it's because Sisko lost his wife that we get the Sisko that we will be on the journey with for 7 seasons.
In a big way, you know, I think in Tapestry, we get a little bit of, you know, the fact that Picard was in the fight with the Nausicaan.
You're right.
And her, that shaped his character, how he reacted to situations moving forward. But it's on a single character scale. And what Sisko's talking about to the prophets here is not simply about himself, but the nature of existence for what the prophets call corporeal beings, right?
Right.
So he's arguing for the bigger picture.
I thought it was fascinating, though, at the prophets' shock that we as humans would make choices without knowing what the consequences were. Mm-hmm. And how that just seemed to be like... I mean, you choose to do things and you don't know what's going to happen. Why would
That's totally alien to them.
Right. I mean, the fact that, I mean, are they existing in all points of time at the same time? So they have no linear progression. They have no past. They have no future. And trying to wrap your head around that, every choice that they make, they know the outcome. Mm-hmm. You know, so it just is. And for us to come stumbling in there, you know, with our human brains and all of our little quirks, and then this whole thing of linear time, I think it was well written, but at the same time, I mean, as a viewer back, you know, when this was first coming on, that it actually started making me think, you know, how would that even be? And, you know, and then every aspect of our lives, everything you do, there's a consequence. You know, hey, I'm on the show tonight. Might have decided to do something else. I could have gone, you know, tomorrow's Memorial Day. Yeah, I'll go have a few beers. And that changes the entire flow of my life because I did something without knowing the consequences. And here's Sisko saying, no, that's why we do things, is because we don't know the outcome. And that's what gives us the drive to go forward.
I think that's why I say that Deep Space Nine still maintains the Roddenberry heart. Is that we are, in spite of it being so radically different from TOS and TNG, we're still examining the human condition in this series. More, and I would say even to a more introverted, more personal stance than even TOS or TNG did.
Yeah, and that's, for me, the core of Star Trek, has always been the core of Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the series is very true to Star Trek, even though the wrappings of it may be a little bit different.
It's got that gritty cover. And it may be a little darker than the brightly colored series that we've had before, but it does fall in line with examining the human condition with that bright future. Because even the darkest points of Deep Space Nine, we still have hope of a brighter future. I mean, than we have now. I mean, we know that we're going to overcome this adversity. I mean, even the manufactured adversity in Deep Space Nine, you know that these characters are going to be strong enough to overcome it, because you've seen, you know, building up to this, that we have that potential. And I mean, the human race, the Federation, has proven time and time again that they can and they will, you know, come back. And it's almost like the what was it, Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. Where he kept getting up, and no matter how much he got knocked down, he just kept trying to get up. That's the Federation. That's Starfleet. The Klingons can hammer us into the ground. The Cardassians can hammer us into the ground. The Borg will, you know, assimilate half your crew, but we keep getting up. And that's Star Trek to me.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, only a body like the Federation, like the way Ben describes, only something like that would be able to survive the Dominion War and still rise above and come out of the ashes like a phoenix, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That's your first contact reference there, right? Okay, so a lot of fascinating stuff in this episode, as well as great character development. And I think we've gone quite a bit past an hour discussing Emissary. We're almost as long as the episode itself. So I guess we will wrap up discussion for this time. I almost feel like we could do a whole other feature just talking about the time element of Emissary.
Yeah,
so mm-hmm. we might do that one of these days. Maybe we'll do a feature about the prophets one of these days.
That would be cool.
I think that's what
awesome.
We need to do. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. So before we go, Matt, tell everyone where they can find you.
Yeah, you can find the Delta Quadrant podcast at deltaquadrantpodcast.libsyn.com. We're also, all four of the hosts, including myself, are on Twitter. I'm at mhansen0207, and the Delta Quadrant podcast is at Delta Quadrant Cast, and that's DELT_QADT cast.
Okay. We'll put a link in the show notes to that one, because I know that one is a little bit hard to type in.
Yeah, it's a little bit tricky. I always have to spell it out phonetically for people. And
right.
Absolutely. All right, great. And Ben, tell everyone where they can find you.
Well, you can catch up with me and the rest of the USS Boner crew for Dork Trek at www.dorktrek.com. I went all 90s there with www, but
at least you didn't say http://.
I almost did, but at dorktrek.com you can find and listen to the episodes. We're on Twitter. Each of us have our own accounts, but you can find us at dorktrek, and we're pretty much everywhere. If you can find Dork Trek, and then you can find the individual crew members as we run around the Intertrons.
All right. And yeah, and great show. Greg and I are, of course, huge fans of Dork Trek.
So am I. If you haven't listened to Dork Trek out there, listeners, if you want the most raunchiest, fun, sort of out of this world take on Next Generation, you will not be disappointed at all.
And sometimes right. we actually discuss the episodes that we're reviewing.
Yeah.
Sometimes you talk about the episodes, too. It's a fun journey to find out what you guys are going to talk about as you go along. And then at the end, you come back to the episode and give it a rating.
That's what I loved about this week is, like, Devils do half the episode is Star Trek 09, and, like, we get down to the 20 minutes and, like, oh, shit, we actually have an episode that we have to discuss.
So we're still in the first act, and...
Oh, no, we've had episodes where we look at the clock, and it's like, yeah, we're at the 50-minute mark, and we haven't got to the opening credits yet. Yes. We've started, you know, we're maybe, if you were watching the episode, 3 minutes into the episode, 4 at most, of a 45-minute episode, and we're already at 50 minutes of Dork Trek, so...
Yeah.
I remember fondly the conversation about Geordi's holodeck date, which maybe was, you know, two minutes of booby trap, and...
That was fantastic, yeah. But, you know, it's kind of like
the... That's what's great about Dork Trek.
It's kind of like the prophets say here, you know, we never know what's going to come next when we listen to Dork Trek, so... It's that concept of linear time is just not quite... Yeah. But a great show. So everyone go check out Dork Trek. We'll put a link to that. And of course, Matt and the Delta Quadrant, also one of my favorite podcasts, because you guys are really devoted to Voyager. And that's something that I believe you are still the only podcast that's dedicated to Voyager at this point.
As far as my knowledge goes, you know, we figured it was about time Voyager gets some voice in the podcasting world that wasn't. That doesn't have the words "I hate" in front of Voyager, you know.
Right.
And good reviews too. I mean, very honest discussion of Voyager. It's wonderful, and you guys have a great cast, and of course you have Charlene on there to bring that female perspective. Just as Dork Trek, you guys have Jenny on there as well, Lieutenant Commander, I should say. Jenny's also great. So we need a female voice on the Ready Room, don't we, Greg?
We do. We need a regular female. I'm trying to find one. I have a few possibilities, so stay tuned.
Other than Char, of course, because she'll just come on and lead us down rat holes into as she calls herself, the sex and relationship expert of Trek FM. So
we didn't talk about anybody having sex on DS9. I don't know if anyone did, but if they did, no one that's on the show today brought it up. So right. Good job, guys.
I think not in this episode, although we did.
Not in this episode. I mean, no.
We did name
Worf and Jadzia are going to be making sweet, sweet love later down the line.
We did name our Mirror Universe DS9 show Interdimensional Booty Call, though. So
that's true.
We did get into that a little bit. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, guys. And we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, one of these days, Chris, I think we're going to finally finish introing DS9. And we'll start actually just talking about the meat of the show itself. But I don't know. There's something about DS9 where it's so rich and the characters are so interesting and the history and the time it was set in. I feel like we could just keep doing Emissary over and over and over again.
I think so. You're right. You know, I said I wanted to do Emissary largely so that we could talk about the time angle. And then, like you mm-hmm. said, we ended up talking more about the setup of the concept of the show and the characters and all more than the time. But I am writing my episode right. guide for Emissary right now. I'm almost finished. And in that one, I will talk more about the time element than we did in the show today. So
that's good. Yeah.
Get my thoughts there.
I'd like to get to it. I don't know. I'm kind of let down by the way the prophets are handled. If you read the Kurt Vonnegut book, Slaughterhouse-5, it involves some aliens that live in the fourth dimension. And so they sort of look at us in the same way that they don't understand why we're traveling through time where they just see it all laid out. And I think it's a much better examination of the concept. So it would be interesting to talk about that on the show. So maybe we'll get back to the prophets at some point on the show for just a special prophets episode.
A special prophets episode brought to you by the prophets. Coming to you.
You know, perhaps a year from now, perhaps yesterday.
Exactly. Coming to you sometime. Then or now. All right. Well, it was also great to have Matt and Ben on the show. Two podcasts that we listen to all the time, but yet we had never had either of them on the show before. And I know they both love DS9, so a great opportunity to talk about the series, sometimes the forgotten series of Star Trek, I feel.
Yeah, definitely. It's probably one of the most not talked about. Where it is, it's the one where if you're an intense nerd, it's the one that really sets up the whole Star Trek universe, as we talked about. So, yeah, I'm digging my way through season 6 of Next Gen right now, and I'm really looking forward to getting onto DS9 and get to a rewatch, because I feel like I just rewatched it, but if I look at the timeline, it was actually 2 or 3 years ago that I watched DS9, and so I don't actually even remember all of these bits and pieces. So I'm really excited to get back into this.
Yeah, I just set out on a DS9 rewatch myself. We'll see how well I do with it, because sometimes I try to rewatch series and I get like 2 seasons in and then I kind of fade out because of other life responsibilities, right. But I'm going to try to get through it at that point. All right, Greg, well, let's tell everyone where they can find us if they would like to send us their thoughts on Emissary, Deep Space Nine, anything else we talked about today, or to let us know that they are going to be getting their tickets for that special con with the 47 captains. And to do that, you can go to trek.fm/contact and you can send us a text message that way, an email. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and on Google Plus at hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. And of course, you'll find us on Twitter, which is where we are always talking about Star Trek. And that's at username TrekFM. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I'm there at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN. And when I'm not, you know, drowning my sorrows in gin, I'm tweeting about Star Trek. And I want to have a special shout out to everyone who wished me a happy birthday last week. Thank you, guys. I didn't realize so many people were paying attention and want to wish me a happy birthday. So that was really great all day, you know, picking my iPhone, and every time there'd be another tweet or a Facebook message from one of you. So I really appreciate that. I had a fantastic birthday year, and a big part of that was you guys.
Definitely. We do have great support from our listeners. So yeah, thank you to everyone for that and all the support in general. All right. Also, we would like to encourage you to drop by iTunes if you like the show. If you'd like to go by, leave us a rating and a review. That helps other people find the show. And plus, we just like hearing from you as well. So please drop by and do that. All right, Greg. Well, I think that just about wraps up this Ready Room as we launch into a new year of Ready Rooms. And I've had a great time doing the show with you for the past year. I can't believe that we've been doing it for a year. Hard to imagine, especially with the way that the show came about in the first place and how we met. Mm-hmm. But it's been a great 12 months. So I'll raise my glass of Romulan ale to you for another 12 months of the Ready Room.
Yes, indeed. And I'll raise my glass of blood wine or Bloody Mary, whatever the case it may be.
Just keep believing that's blood wine. All right. Well, I'm going to head off. I'm going to go stare into the Orb of the Prophets for a little while and just see what I can find out.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick some cupcake in it because the Ready Room is done. Help me!